Welcome to Traveling Culturati, where we explore cultures and share travel news, travel tips, destinations, and travel chats. Visit TravelingCulturati.com for more information.
Well, hey there, fellow Culturati. Javon Harley here, your host and travel pro for Traveling Culturati. Make sure you head on over to the website, TravelingCulturati.com. And join the travel club. Well, Japan is sold out, but there's still a chance for Peru coming up in August 15th through the 25th. Actually, we also have Singapore and Bali with the Michael Baisden Travel Club. We're partnering with him on that. That's August 1st through the 10th. You can get all of the information going to TravelingCulturati.com. Go ahead, join in the fun, but make sure you join the travel club. You know, joining me today is healthcare professional Yolanda Como with another edition and installment of Staying Healthy While You're Traveling. Traveling for medical purposes, also known as medical tourism. There's a lot of people doing it in a lot of countries that offer great services. So we're going to give you the ins and outs of that. We'll also have Javon's Travel Minute and, of course, the Culture Report. But you know we always start with some travel news, and that's what we're going to do right now. It's been 5 years, folks, but Notre Dame is nearing its reopening. It's almost here. It's actually on schedule to be reopened in December after 5 years. And that was because of the devastating fire. The restoration of Notre Dame Cathedral is nearing that completion. And of course, we have the Summer Olympics in Paris. The reopening is scheduled, as I said, for December and is currently running on schedule, according to Felipe Jost, who is the official leading the project. Jost, a trained engineer who spent much of his career in the defense ministry, took over the job after his predecessor, General Jean-Louis Georgelin, died in a hiking accident in August 2023. So sorry and rest in peace. Jost told lawmakers that the project had so far cost 550 million euros, that's about $587 million, funded in part by massive donations, including those from luxury sector billionaires like François-Henri Pinault and also the Arnault family. So much money has been donated that there will even be funds left over for future and further investment in the building. An additional 150 million euros should be made available, provided the approval of certain sponsors will be used to restore the cathedral and tackle problems that predate the fire, which mainly concerned the exterior stonework. Jost also stated that the construction work is work of a lifetime because restoring an entire monument in all its three dimensionalities, that's quite exceptional. Emma Rue, an artisan working on the iconic stained glass, chimed in as well. On the evening of April 15, 2019, the cathedral's roof burst into flames. Soon, it had engulfed the spire and almost toppled the main bell towers. Around the world, TV news and viewers watched with horror as the medieval building burned. Macron, whose second and final term ends in 2027, wants the cathedral's restoration to lift the nation's mood and his government's approval ratings, of course. Only once in a century does one host the Olympic and Paralympic Games, and only once in a millennium does one rebuild a cathedral. This is what Macron said in his 2024 New Year speech. It remains unclear what exactly caused the fire 5 years ago. French authorities said that it could have been an electrical fault or a burning cigarette may have been responsible. A firefighter said that after taking a good look at the facade, because if we manage to put out the fire, it will go in ruins as well. The facade held, but the damage has needed 5 years of intense stabilization and restoration work. Now, if you're traveling to Brazil, this is what you'll need to know over the next couple of years. Yes, next year, you'll need to share your bank statements with the South African nation first. Travelers from the U.S., Canada, and Australia will need to obtain a visa before entering the country. And this is beginning April 10, 2025, according to a Brazilian government-authorized website. To complete the visa application, visitors must provide proof of income for travel by showing their last three checking or savings account statements or at least six previous pay stubs. If you don't have at least $2,000 in your bank account, you'll need a sponsor, typically a friend or family member, to sign a document called an affidavit of support. This is accepting financial responsibility for you. Other requirements include a passport, of course, a letter of intent, proof of residence, plane or bus tickets, lodging reservations, and a payment of $80.90. Visas to Brazil are valid for 10 years across multiple entries, according to the country's U.S. embassy. Stays are restricted to 90 days per year. Now, before you get your knickers in a twist, the U.S. has similar requirements for Brazilian citizens who want to travel to America for tourism. To obtain a U.S. visa, Brazilians must have a valid passport and pay $185 application fee. They must also schedule a visa interview appointment at their nearest embassy, as well as provide documentation of outlining the purpose of their visit and their ability to pay for the entire trip, as noted on the U.S. State Department's website. The U.S. State Department said Brazil's visa requirement was supposed to be reinstated this April, but once again, it was postponed. It was initially postponed in October, then in January, according to the Associated Press. So here's what you can expect. Up until 2019, American, Australia, and Canadian tourists needed a visa to visit Brazil. But former president removed the requirement to boost the tourism industry, according to the Associated Press. However, the three countries still demanded visas from Brazilians coming to their country. So the president's predecessor, President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, decided to reintroduce the requirement to maintain reciprocity between the countries. And international travel is shaking up the world's busiest airports list. Yes, things have changed. The sheer volume of air passengers last year reflects a really robust return to travel and a shift toward tourism hotspots in Asia and the Middle East. Close to 8.5 billion passengers took a plane trip last year, according to Airports Council International, or ACI, world's just released list of the top 10 busiest airports worldwide. So the total volume of passengers represents a 27% overall jump from 2022, fueled by a 37% boost of international travel market. That nearly doubled the 20% increase for domestic travel. So, who has held the top spot and continues to do so for more than two decades? Well, that's Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport in Atlanta. Yes, four other U.S. airports have landed in the top 10. Dallas-Fort Worth fell one spot only to number three. Denver fell three spots to number six. Los Angeles fell two spots to number eight. And Chicago fell five spots to number nine. So the world's busiest airports in 2023 by total volume. In order, number one, Hartsfield-Jackson, Atlanta. Number two, Dubai, UAE Airport. Dallas-Fort Worth, London Heathrow, Tokyo Haneda, Denver, Istanbul, Turkey, Los Angeles or LAX, Chicago O'Hare, and number 10 is Delhi in India. So if we want to look at a wider lens and look at the world's busiest airports only based on international travel, is in order, number one, starting with Dubai, then London Heathrow, Schiphol in Netherlands, Paris's Charles de Gaulle, Singapore Changi, Incheon in South Korea, Frankfurt, Germany, Doha, Qatar, and number 10 is Madrid, Spain. So yeah, things are shaking up a little bit, moving around, people are moving spots, airports are moving spots, becoming the busiest, but it certainly is a lens into what's happening in the tourism business and where people are traveling to. The biggest movers are in Asia and the Middle East. So this airport was just named the most luxurious airport in the United States. So in February, All Clear Travel Insurance unveiled the findings of its research searching for the most luxurious airports in the world. To determine its rankings, the insurance service analyzed more than 1,800 airports, evaluating them on how many had a significant selection of passenger lounges available. This is minimum 10 via data by LoungeBuddy. How many designer shops it has, and how many 4- and 5-star hotels are located nearby. Each airport was also given a score on whether travelers could find a champagne bar or caviar house too, because, well, you know, we need that. After looking at all the airports, the team shortlisted 69 and named New York's John F. Kennedy International Airport, or JFK as we like to call it, as the most luxurious airport in the United States. JFK ranked as the 11th most luxurious airport overall, scoring high marks for its high number of lounges, 22 in total, and for the high number of luxury stores across its terminals, 16 in total. However, it lost points because it lacks any high-end hotels nearby, giving it a total luxury score of 48 out of 100. And this pales in comparison to the number one pick, which is Dubai International Airport. It scored 83 out of 100. Coming in a close second is the United Kingdom's London Heathrow Airport, located in London with a score of 82 out of 100. Also in the top five are Hamad International Airport in Doha, that's in Qatar, Paris's Charles de Gaulle Airport in France, and Sydney International Airport in Australia. The other U.S. airport to make the top 20, California's Los Angeles International Airport at number 16. In Traveling While Black news, if you'd like to support Black-owned businesses when you travel, you can support on your next layover in Atlanta, Seattle, Nashville, and in Miami. So Jackson's Soul Food in Miami is located in the Miami International Airport in Miami, Florida. They can be found on the second level near Gate E2. In Atlanta, you have H&H Hospitality. It's a Black-owned airport concessions company that operates several brands inside Atlanta's Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport, Freshens Yogurt, Famous Familia Pizzeria, and the company has also partnered ventures that manage an Auntie Anne's and a Shake Shack inside the airport. Africa Lounge in Seattle-Tacoma International Airport in Seattle, Washington. Africa Lounge is a restaurant that offers African-inspired cuisine, some wines, and cocktails. You can find them near Gate A4. In Tennessee, the Tennessee Tribune News and Gifts. This is located inside Nashville International Airport. And it's a unique concept that offers travel essentials, local businesses, and other necessary items. They're located near Gate C1. Well, that's all I've got for travel news. And when I come back, healthcare professional Yolanda Como is here with another edition of Staying Healthy While You Travel. This time, we're looking at medical tourism, traveling for medical purposes.
This is Traveling Culturati. We explore cultures and destinations. We share travel news and travel tips to keep you well informed and prepared for your next travel adventure. So go ahead and up your travel game with Traveling Culturati. Visit TravelingCulturati.com for more information.
Welcome back to the Traveling Culturati. I'm your host and travel pro, Javon Harley. Make sure you head on over to the website, TravelingCulturati.com, and join that travel club. Sad to say that Japan is sold out, but we still have some spaces available for Peru coming up August 15th. Through the 25th. And we're working on some fabulous destinations coming up in 2025 that you won't want to miss, but you have to sign up for the travel club and the newsletter at travelingculturati.com. Well, joining me today and back for another installment of Staying Healthy While You Travel is healthcare professional Yolanda Como. It's always good to stay healthy and keep that top of mind when you're traveling. Hello, Yolanda, and welcome back.
Hello, Javon. I'm glad to be back.
So, what are we tackling today in this edition of Staying Healthy While You Travel?
I thought we'd talk a little bit about people traveling abroad for medical purposes, for medical reasons, and to have their medical concerns or their medical wishes taken care of because most of them are going for personal reasons and basically for cosmetic reasons. So I thought we can talk more about it and also all the countries that are offering the services and what kind of services that they're offering.
Well, you're certainly hearing about it more and more, all under the umbrella of medical tourism. And I know you're a healthcare professional here in the United States, so I have to tread lightly here, but I think a lot of people are going to other countries because it's price prohibitive for less expensive services. But there's certainly a lot of things that you have to consider. But there are some countries that just excel in certain areas of medicine. And that's another reason that people travel for it. And like you said, people travel for medical purposes. And one thing I've learned, because I automatically assumed that people mainly go for cosmetic, but that's not necessarily the case. Some people are traveling for major medical that has nothing to do with cosmetics.
That's true. You know, on that note, it's known as medical tourism. So, like you said, it's become very, very popular to the point where I personally know people who have gone. I haven't gone. So, it's offered because it's people are traveling because other countries are offering attractive medical services like cosmetic surgeries and also complex procedures like, believe it or not, organ transplants and cardiac services. It's a specific country is known to be better or more innovative than people. And, you know, patients and customers, they do their research and they seek out these areas before they travel and they see who's doing the best, who's having the best results. And they're paying the money. They're getting on planes, hopping on planes, and they're taking cash with them and they're having the services done. And yes, it is because mainly because of the cost. You know, it's a lot cheaper. If you can pay the money and you want the service and that country is providing it, then, like I said, people are hopping on planes and they're getting it done.
So let's kind of talk about the things that more specifically that people are doing, and if it's related to a particular country, where are people going and what are they getting done?
For instance, our North American neighbors is very popular. It's a destination that boasts robust medical tourism industries like the country itself, but also medical services such as orthopedic surgeries. The cost is very low, and it's the second largest country in the world that has a reputation of offering high quality and top of the line healthcare services. For the citizens themselves, there's a wait list for services to happen, but according to their taxes and everything, I wouldn't say it's free. It's they pay because, you know, throughout their taxes. But whereas in the United States, yes, we do pay taxes, but we also have to pay insurance and medical costs. That's opposite in places like Canada. It's very affordable than the United States, and it's really it has a big booming medical tourism system. And since they're so close to the United States, people are going there and they're having things done.
I was going to say they're our neighbors to the north, as we like to call them. They do have a national healthcare system that is taken care of through their taxes. Now, do they have specialties or particular areas in medicine, or is it more of a general, since they are the second largest country in the world that has a reputation for offering high quality and top of the line healthcare facilities?
Not specifically what they can do. They service just like the United States, but it's high quality, top of the line service as well as it is in the United States, but that comes at a very low cost.
What are some of the other countries that are known for or that people are flocking to for medical tourism and what their specialties would be?
Places like Singapore and Korea, they're known for cosmetic surgeries and they can just change the whole look of you. Beautiful skincare. I know someone who recently went to South Korea, and they said as soon as you get off the plane, immediately it starts hitting you all the signage in the airports, signage in the subway, signage all on the streets, billboards, and it's all about cosmetics. And this individual brought back boxes of the facial mask and the little packets. And it was like all types. So it was like the cost of pennies for these particular masks. And we probably are paying here $20 a package, which you probably got them for just, you know, probably a dollar. I mean, it was like boxes of them.
If not more. I mean, I've paid upwards of $50, $75 for some high-end ones, and I'm sure they're high-end to me. There's probably some that are high-end to others that could be well over $100 or so for these masks. But I do know that South Korea is very well known for their cosmetic products, their facial, especially skincare products and lines, and they're usually quite pricey here.
Very pricey. You can probably get like, what, $100, $200 facial here. Probably will cost you just pennies there. They also do a lot of facial sculpting. Yeah, scoping, like your nose, people come back with changes in their nose. I mean, just new innovative treatments.
So is Singapore in the same vein of skincare and cosmetic surgery? So anything new that Singapore has done recently?
They recently set up something called an IPSC, their International Patient Service Centers, where their medical tourism industry is better organized. And they act as an liaison between medical tourism, Singapore healthcare providers to make the service better managed. So they're bringing in high quality skilled people to help them provide the services of people coming in from various countries, coming in abroad, and things are being managed properly and smoothly.
I want to go through the rest of the list of those destinations that are offering medical tourism and how that looks for them. But we will also want to talk about some of the things that you really need to watch out for, because I have some questions that I'll ask you a little bit later, because you're talking about healthcare. And, you know, even if it relates to somebody going for cosmetic surgery, I like that Singapore is establishing something that'll work with Singapore healthcare providers as well. So we want to delve into that a little bit more, but let's still talk about the other destinations. You have Japan on the list. So it seems like Asia is really big. So what is Japan doing?
Japan has incorporated the latest technology and medical advances in their healthcare systems, things that they can deliver like top-notch healthcare. Japan itself, healthcare and treatments of cancer, and they're known for that. And places like Japan, it is expensive. You may find that when you're traveling there. However, they have health centers that are managed as non-profits, and that's what keep their costs down. So once again, people mainly, not just for the care that they're going to receive and the services that they're going to receive, they're traveling because the cost of it is minimal. What we're paying in here in the United States, thousands upon thousands of dollars for just, I wouldn't say simple things, but just for any service, especially if you're out of pocket. You're paying very minimum amount if you're traveling to other countries to have those services taken care of. And if those countries are top of the notch, they have, like I said, most innovative, advanced equipment or technology, then yeah, you will like to travel there and experience that and experience the services there. And yeah, you wouldn't mind paying out of pocket because it's going to be little to none out of your pocket. I mean, I just paid so much money for recent dental service out of pocket. I have insurance, but I had to pay so much more even out of pocket. And to be honest with you, I'm not even happy with the service. I'm back and forth to the dentist to make because of corrections. But Japan is one of the places that have the latest advanced medical technology that people are scurrying to have.
And now there's something else you say here that while you mentioned that it is expensive in Japan, that they have a factor that drives medical tourism because it has low treatment costs. So can you expound on that, that while Japan is expensive, they have low treatment costs? How is that?
Right, because of their health systems are managed by not-for-profits, thus keeping their costs down for their customers and patients, even in the country itself. And it's offered to those who are traveling for medical tourism as well. So you're paying, but you're paying out of pocket, but the cost is very low.
Now, what about Spain? I really hadn't thought about Spain as a destination for medical tourism, but certainly it's on your list.
Yeah, Spain have advancements in orthopedics and also cosmetic and dental. And that's what a lot of people are flying across the waters for. They want those vibrant dental care, like teeth and veneers. In Spain, also, they have the high quality care of cosmetic and dental care and orthopedic care, but it's at a very low cost. Once again, at a very low cost. They also boast that they have the Joint Commission, the accreditation for hospitals that we have here in the United States, that's also regulating their systems there. So that's another plus, because if you know that you have an agency like the Joint Commission who's making sure that you're staying accountable for your care that you're delivering, you can't beat that. That's a plus. You go there, you have your care, you know that it's being serviced and it's being monitored and keeping you relevant and making sure that you're staying accountable, but you wouldn't mind paying that low cost that the service is being offered to you. And the care is just beautiful, because I said people have come back from Spain, various places, for this dental care, and they have beautiful smiles and their teeth and their dental care looks wonderful.
Now, United Kingdom on the list. Again, I really wouldn't think of them as a destination for medical tourism, because I do see them as in that place that's expensive. It's a smaller country, even though I know we're talking about several countries that make up the United Kingdom.
Well, United Kingdom, yeah, they are known for their cosmetic treatments, but it's more so for corrective surgeries, like facial fillers and cosmetic procedures for correcting, like jaw surgeries and, you know, anything that's facial.
And I'm glad you brought that up, corrective. Because a lot of times when we think of cosmetic surgery, we think it's really because we want to change things, or maybe there's more of a personal reason, and there's nothing wrong with that. But mentioning corrective, you know, sometimes people have deformities or they've had some trauma, and cosmetic surgery is part of correcting those things as well. Could be someone who had, you know, a burn victim in a accident or a deformity that they could have been born with that needs correcting for better health for the person. Now, Dubai is surprising to me, but not surprising to me. Dubai itself is the city or state, but UAE, the country that's known for its modern marvels, especially when it comes to architecture. But I didn't think of them for medical tourism.
Yeah, they're known for their architecture and their luxury shopping experiences. I haven't been to Dubai, but I've heard about it. Streets with gold and the ATMs with gold bars and things like that. But they do specialize in cancer treatment and dental procedures. Infertility is big, and dermatology and skincare as well. It will be out of pocket, like most of the places abroad. And just being in a beautiful place too, that's another reason why people travel abroad on the medical tourist. They spend time there, because some of these procedures, you will have to stay there. You don't just get on the plane, have your procedure, and the next day or the same day you get back on the plane and leave. That's not the case. You have to spend time there for recovery. So if you're there, I mean, what a place to be in. But Dubai, a beautiful place like that, and to enjoy and to relax and recover as well.
A place a little closer to home, Costa Rica.
Yeah, Costa Rica is ranked pretty high on the list. It is a developing country, a developing nation, but it is known for its dentistry and cosmetic surgery procedures and cancer treatment, bariatric surgery, and other things as well, and eye surgery. It's a beautiful place as well, where it has exotic recovery retreats for medical travelers so they can relax and recover in a serene ambience environment. And that's what I'm saying. A lot of people choose these places according to the environment to relax and have a relaxing experience as they recover from the procedures that they're having done. And Costa Rica is definitely one of the places, seeked out places to go to have your services to relax in.
So what are some of the other destinations that are considered for medical tourism?
Places like Israel, but Israel is having its challenges right now with the war that's happening, but they are recognized as one of the innovators of cancer treatments, orthopedic surgeries, neurology, and bone marrow transplants, eye surgeries. So they deliver high quality surgery care as well. Places like Abu Dhabi, like we just talked about, Dubai, they also provide high quality healthcare. It's a high quality healthcare facilities there who offer top-notch healthcare and for medical tourists, where they can enjoy their beautiful views and tourist attractions in the country as they recover as well. Places like Mexico and Turkey, and of course, like I said, Costa Rica, they offer excellent dental services and cosmetic dental care. So people flock there. And like I said, I personally know two people who've gone to Turkey for some dental care, and they have beautiful teeth and smiles. And India, they specialize in bypass surgeries. They have high-end complex procedures. They do hip replacements and cardiac care and cardiac and cosmetic surgeries as well. But they do have a visa policy. It does allow the patients to stay up to 60 days during their recovery and while they're visiting for their medical treatments.
Well, who have you found are the people who are going for medical tourism?
They're usually well-traveled people. They're people who are inquisitive and just want to be in the know. They're well-educated people. People, of course, who have money. They're affluent. And it's usually people from the age of 30 to 65-year-olds. They're a substantial portion of the target audience who are jumping on planes and traveling abroad and getting the best of the best medical care and at very low to minimum costs, and coming back looking fresh and healthy and vibrant after being gone for whatever period of time to treatments.
Now, what are some of the challenges that countries are facing in medical tourism?
When you're here at home, you know, in the United States, and you're having your treatment or having surgery, you know there's always follow-up care. So you have to go see your own primary physician or go back to whoever did the surgery within a certain period of time. But that would be a challenge, going back abroad to get a follow-up on something that you had done weeks prior or a month or so prior. And if there's a complication, anything can happen. You can have an infection. You can have something that you did have altered on you in terms of cosmetic. You're not happy with it. So who's going to correct that? So do you get back on the plane and see if you can try and get that corrected? Or do you find someone here or someone in the United States to probably take your case on? A lot of times, I don't know if you've seen the program called Botch.
Yeah, I have.
And they do a lot of correcting of cosmetic surgeries that people have gone abroad to have done, or not even abroad. They might have had it in the country, in the United States itself, and they find a doctor who can correct things, make things right because something has been botched. But mostly it's from going abroad, and it depends on where you've gone abroad to have it done. Also, the challenges could be language barriers. What you're wanting, sometimes you don't get what you're wanting because it probably wasn't truly understood or explained properly.
Lost in translation, yeah.
If you are going, do you know for sure if they have skilled professionals who are going to care for you the way that you think that you're going to be cared for? And a lot of the facilities in those countries, they're in a lot of their skilled professionals because those people are going to other countries who are paying higher earnings. And if they're not getting the higher earnings in the countries where you're traveling to have your procedure, they're going to go elsewhere. And who knows what type of skilled people they're going to have in place of them. And there could be medical problems in these other countries that you're probably not aware of. And because of the laws, like we have a lot of laws here in the United States that's keeping the healthcare system accountable. Systems like the Joint Commission or your state health department. Do they have that in other countries? So that's probably something that you really need to look into prior to going to make sure that you will be protected and these facilities will be held accountable for the services that they are going to provide for you.
Those are really serious things that you should really consider and not just look at the service that you want to get and where to go to get it. But these are excellent points as far as follow-up care, language barriers, skill level of the professionals, and the country itself that you're going to. Is it going to be a developing country that has other issues outside of medical? And what are those medical facilities like there? And certainly legal, because there's not much recourse there when you're outside of the United States, because they may either not exist or
maybe they don't apply to you because you're not a citizen of that country. So how does medical tourism help a country?
They can support the locals there by, yes, they keep their costs down. People are coming in and they're having the services. So the countries are able to build their economy from that. Their economy booms because of tourism. And medical tourism is just another part of tourism supporting the country. So that's how the countries are being supported and how they're building their economy and supporting their citizens.
How does it impact their healthcare system?
Well, it improves their healthcare quality of the country because it boosts the economy. So they can pour that money in to help to improve their healthcare systems in those countries.
My concern and what I would wonder is if they have foreigners coming in who may pay more than locals would pay, would they get precedent over or priority over locals? And so will they then be faced with an issue of foreigners are coming in, but we don't have space or the capacity for locals who are looking for some of these? Now, I know some of these are elective, but some of them are not elective. Some of these are major things that people may need to improve their lives that it's not just for cosmetic reasons. But what are some things that we need to keep in mind when planning to travel for medical tourism?
So when planning, think about, you know, the place that you're going and where you're going to have it done and where you're going to have it done. Is it safe? Any kind of medical treatment outside the United States or even in the United States, but more so outside the United States, it will pose a risk to you traveling abroad and having it done. Because depending on where you're going and if it's undeveloped country, and once again, if there's no accreditation system that's keeping that facility abreast and accountable for what they're doing, are they sterilizing their equipment properly? And that's very, very important because infections can come in. And be honest with you, in healthcare, we see this. We see people coming and they have really bad infections. And once infections get into your system, you can die from just having whatever you had done. I mean, if you had liposuction or breast lift or whatever you're having done cosmetically, and if it's invasive, you open yourself up to very dangerous roads here. And you have to think about that. You also should be thinking about how long is it going to take you to heal? I mean, how long do you need to remain in that destination at that place post-operatively, like after the surgery? How long does it take for you to recover and get back on the plane to come back home? So you need to be aware of that and do your research about it. And how much is that going to cost you? Staying even longer. And if you need to factor in those costs, have you arranged with the facility about you staying there additional time? And does the money that you're going to be paying for the procedure, does that include you staying? And if it does include you staying, where are you going to be staying? Do they have a facility for you to stay? Does it include transportation to and from airports? Or are you going to be fed? There's so many things that you really, really have to think about. The most important thing is adverse occurrences like infections. What are the signs and symptoms of that after the procedure and you just traveled abroad and now you're back on the plane and you're not feeling well? Is that a sign that you're getting an infection? Will you make it home in time to be treated at the local facility once you get back? And is anybody going to be able to take you on? Because you know what? A lot of times when people have these procedures abroad and they come back and they're not feeling well, they hold off themselves from even going for treatment. For many reasons, because they don't want someone to know. And the longer you wait and you are developing an infection, that could be life or death.
Well, it sounds like to me, certainly, that if you are going to embark on this, and I do know that there are some facilities abroad that work with U.S. facilities, but it sounds like it would be in your interest to actually discuss this with your doctor and ask about, in the event of any complications, or even set it up where somebody can do a complete checkup when you come back. But with most surgeries, there's always a period, that first checkup with the doctor to make sure everything is healing properly or that there are no infections and things setting in. So that post-operative checkup, that first checkup at least, or getting that clearance to get back on that flight, especially if you're talking about a 16, 17 hour flight. That's very different than a 1 hour flight or even a 2 or 3 hour flight. That's quite a bit of time. But unfortunately, we're out of time today. Excellent topic and a whole lot to think about. There are some books out there for medical tourism. There's not a whole lot of help as far as generally speaking, because it is such a broad item itself, and there's not one body that governs it all. So you really just have to do your due diligence, ask a lot of questions, talk to your own doctor and all of those things. Any final thoughts from you?
Yeah, like you said, just do your due diligence, do your research, talk to your doctor, and have a safe journey and wonderful care.
Great. Well, Yolanda, thank you so much again for keeping us healthy while we travel.
You're welcome.
When I come back, I've got the culture report.
This is Traveling Culturati. We explore cultures and destinations. We share travel news and travel tips to keep you well informed and prepared for your next travel adventure. So go ahead and up your travel game with Traveling Culturati. Visit travelingculturati.com for more information.
Welcome back to the Traveling Culturati. I'm your host and travel pro, Javon Harley. Make sure you head on over to the website, travelingculturati.com, and also follow us on social media and join that travel club because we go to some fantastic places. Well, it is Black History Month, and I just love this time of year because I get to explore, discover, and share so many wonderful aspects of Black history with you. So I'm super excited to have on with me today Saladin Allah, who is the Director of Community Engagement at the Niagara Falls Underground Railroad Heritage Center. He's a historian, an educator, and the third great-grandson of the famed Underground Railroad seeker Josiah Henson, the inspiration for the character in Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin. Well, hello, Saladin, if I may call you Saladin, and welcome to Traveling Culturati.
Hey, Javon, how you doing today?
I am fantastic. So big question, have you always known you were the third great-grandson of Josiah Henson?
This is something that I grew up knowing because my family dynamics was rooted in cultural consciousness. And my parents were both affiliated with the Black Panthers. So I grew up knowing the importance of not only our ancestry, but the love and appreciation for the contributions of our people throughout the world. So I didn't learn to more appreciate it until I got older, but it was just something that we always knew just growing up, me and my peers and my siblings.
How was it learning about your heritage and your connection to Josiah Henson?
It gave me a sense of pride and a sense of identity. And growing up in a household where at a very young age, my parents, for example, my father, he collected African artifacts. And when I'm in elementary school, I had the capacity to be able to talk to my peers about the Maasai tribe or the Dinka tribe or the Twa people of Africa. So I was always conscious that our story didn't begin in slavery here in the Western Hemisphere. And because of that, I was able to see our contribution as first world people, as original people, from a much broader perspective. So my sense of esteem was a lot different. And to be able to connect that esteem to a freedom seeker who, for people who are not aware of who Josiah Henson is, he was a forerunner of the Underground Railroad. And to kind of put it in context, he made his journey in 1830 to freedom. And at that time period, Harriet Tubman's name was Araminta Ross, and she was still a young teen on a plantation. So to know part of his story and the sacrifices that he and his family made, as well as the contributions, it gave me even more pride in who I was as a person of African descent.
Let's talk more about Josiah Henson. And I really want to clarify the difference between the character Uncle Tom in the book, mm-hmm. Uncle Tom's Cabin, and the real mm-hmm. person that the book was inspired by, your ancestor, Josiah Henson.
Yes. So the more contemporary concept of what an Uncle Tom is really a caricature of who Josiah Henson actually was. When Harriet Beecher Stowe first published that book, it was the best-selling novel of the 19th century, and to this day is often considered the greatest novel that's ever been written. Abraham Lincoln actually checked a copy of that book out weeks before he drafted the Emancipation Proclamation. So that book is also looked at as the inspiration that sparked the Civil War. That book highlighted the life experience of Josiah Henson as the central narrative. And a lot of people were in an uproar when that book was published because that was the first time that slavery was put on public display. A lot of people who lived in the South, they understood the system of slavery, but a lot of people up North and some of the people who began to settle in the West, they really didn't fully understand what was going on. And this book that Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote put it on public display. And copyright laws are not the same as they were back then. So you had people writing editorials, publishing letters, doing stage plays, doing everything that they could do to try to discredit Harriet Beecher Stowe. And this changed the narrative and made Uncle Tom into a propaganda that to this day, a lot of people don't even strive to investigate and learn about, because the man behind that caricature is the complete opposite. Josiah Henson was a revolutionary. As I mentioned, he was a forerunner of the Underground Railroad. He was an institution builder. He actually led a black militia during the rebellion of 1837 once he arrived to freedom. And these qualities and characteristics are nothing of what a so-called Uncle Tom would actually be. But because that book that Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote created such an expose of the system of slavery that a lot of people strive to do their best to discredit her. And this is where we get this whole concept of what an Uncle Tom is, but Josiah Henson was the complete opposite.
It's so amazing. Mm-hmm. For so long, we never knew the true history of Josiah Henson. So can you please share that with us and his journey to freedom and arriving in Niagara Falls?
Wow. So he was born in Charles County, Maryland on a tobacco plantation in June of 1789, June 15th. Ironically, one of my daughters is also born on June 15th. So Josiah Henson, his oldest and earliest memory of his father was seeing him come stumble into the slave quarters, holding the side of his head with blood running down the side of his face. And that was the last time that he actually saw his father. It wasn't until he got older that he realized that his father was punished for striving to protect his mother. His mother was being assaulted by an overseer at a neighboring plantation, and he stepped in to protect her. And because of that, he received 100 lashes with a whip and his ear nailed to a post and cut off in front of the entire plantation to instill fear in them. And that was the last time that he saw his father. So he grew up without that father figure in his life. He himself, by the time he turned 18 years old, he was assaulted by an overseer and one of his colleagues who took a wooden plank and hit him across his back, shattering his shoulder blades, as well as breaking his right arm. This disabled him for the rest of his life to the point where he was no longer able to lift his arms above his neckline. But he was still a valuable commodity to his enslaver because of his knowledge, his experience, and his work ethic on the plantation. When he finally decided to escape after learning about the possibility of him being sold down the river into the Deep South in New Orleans, it was at the age of about 41 that he decides to actually escape. And one thing that's unique about his journey is a lot of times when people hear about family members moving from plantation to the next, sometimes family members were actually sold to one plantation to the next. Sometimes family members were sent to plantations to hide. And the reason is because oftentimes enslavers were poor managers of their property and they would go into debt. And if they would go into debt, then their property would be confiscated, which also meant that the people that they owned would be confiscated. So to protect their property, sometimes they would take the people that they owned and send them to plantations that their family members or colleagues actually managed. That's something that happened to Josiah, his family, and some of the other people who were enslaved on the plantation of Isaac Riley in Charles County, Maryland. Isaac sent them to his brother Amos Riley's plantation in Owensboro, Kentucky. Once they got to Owensboro, Kentucky, that's when Josiah learned that he was going to be sold to the Deep South. And that is when he decided to escape. So he walked with his family, which was very rare because typically when people would escape plantations, they would leave in ones or twos. They would rarely take their entire family. Even when Harriet Tubman escaped, she didn't take her entire family with her. Josiah took his wife, and I use the word wife loosely, his four children. Two of them were so small He had to carry them in a knapsack on his back. So in preparation for his escape, he would do chores along the plantation with his children on his back to get accustomed to being able to carry them that distance. They actually escaped in September of 1830, walked over 400 miles from Owensboro, Kentucky, and made it up into Ohio. Once they arrived into Ohio, they were actually welcomed into a territory by the indigenous people who lived there known as the Anishinaabe. The Anishinaabe gave them food, shelter, and then in the morning time, two Anishinaabe scouts pointed them in the direction of Sandusky, Ohio, where they were able to board a ship captained by a man named John Burnham. The ship's name was the Schooner Commerce, which took them from Sandusky, Ohio, up to Buffalo, New York. That entire journey was about 41 days. And once they arrived in Buffalo, New York, they were able to successfully cross over to Fort Erie on October 28th, 1830.
With the Niagara Falls Underground Railroad Heritage Center, does it span over Canada and United States?
Yes. Yeah, so our Niagara Falls Underground Railroad Heritage Center, the physical location is right at the foot of where the suspension bridge once stood. Now, the suspension bridge is important because it was the first international bridge that was constructed that allowed passage for people to get across and back into the United States without utilizing a boat or a steamship. This first being constructed in the 1840s allowed people to ride across on a carriage, walk across, and then by 1855, it began to carry a train. This also coincided with the establishment of the New York Central Railroad, who began to connect railroads across the state of New York and in neighboring states like Pennsylvania. This enabled travelers to jump on a train in Albany or New York City or other different places and ride it all the way here into the city of Niagara Falls. This created a transportation boom. So I say that to say our Niagara Falls Heritage Center is built inside of a customs house of the 1860s, which sat right at the foot of the suspension bridge. This is the same location that Harriet Tubman crossed in November of 1856 on a train with a gentleman by the name of Josiah Joe Bailey to get across to the Canadian side. So when you go inside of our Heritage Center, which is literally right on the border of where the suspension bridge once stood, today it is known as the Whirlpool or the Nexus Bridge, which was built on top of that suspension bridge. You can literally look out the window of our Heritage Center and see the remnants of that suspension bridge where Harriet Tubman crossed in November of 1856.
How does one connect and follow you?
People can connect with me through the Niagara Falls Underground Railroad Heritage Center by following our Facebook page, Niagara Falls Underground Railroad Heritage Center. They can also connect with me personally on Instagram at Atlantis Build. It's the page for my early childhood learning center known as the Atlantis School for Gifted Youngsters that I established as well. So that is one way to connect with me, and then also Saladin Allah on Facebook.
Thank you again for chatting with me today. An honor and a pleasure.
All right. Thank you, Devon.
Ladies and gentlemen,
this is Traveling Culturati. We explore cultures and destinations. We share travel news and travel tips to keep you well informed and prepared for your next travel adventure. So go ahead and up your travel game with Traveling Culturati. Visit travelingculturati.com for more information.